And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org. And where else? iTunes, College Radio. That's where else we are. Are we anywhere else, Nicole?
But not that I can think of.
Anyway, today's Wednesday, June 5th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and with me is Nicole Nelson, and our guest for the entire hour is Erica Bauermeister. Erica is the best-selling author of three novels, The School of Essential Ingredients, Joy for Beginners, and The Lost Art of Mixing, which is primarily the focus of our conversation today. She earned a PhD in literature from the University of Washington and has taught there and at Antioch. Her novels, which might be more accurately called interconnected short stories, center around food, fears, and the families we find or create for ourselves. Hi, Erica.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Great to talk to you again. Let's begin as we always do with you talking about the book and how it came about.
Well, you know, each of my books comes from a different place, but I think they all follow a similar format in terms of their creation, which is perhaps a little unusual. I always say that if you were going to watch the way one of my books is created visually, it would be like watching a slow-motion film of a firework exploding, where it's an image, a bit of dialogue, another image, another bit of dialogue. And this comes over 6 months, a year, 6 years, and then some of the images start repeating, some of the characters start connecting together, and eventually I start to see what the book is about. And I know that that's different from a lot of authors that start at the beginning and go to the middle and go to the end, but that's how my mind works. So. Hmm.
There was a subplot, and I don't think I'm ruining anything by bringing this up, but in your new book, so Al goes into a bookstore and impersonates authors and signs stock as them. And I was curious what inspired that subplot in particular.
Well, actually, Al is the character that started the book. The image I had was of this man lying in bed next to his wife. He's in his early 50s. And her complaints are just kind of coming at him sort of endlessly like waves against a docked boat, you know? And for some reason, I really liked this man. And I thought, he could have a better life. I could help that. You know, I'm a writer. I can do something about this, right? And so as I got to know him better as a character, I started thinking, okay, he needs a rebellion. And the one that came to mind was something that has happened to me constantly. I go around the country and I go into bookstores, and if I don't have an event, I'll say, I'm the author of, you know, School of Essential Ingredients or Joy for Beginners or Lost Art of Mixing, and can I sign stock? And they always say yes, and they run and they get the books, and they've never asked me for identification, not once. So I was starting to think, you know, anybody could do this, really. This would be kind of fun. And it seemed like the perfect rebellion for Al. So, you know, that's kind of where it came from. So often, even though my characters aren't based on anybody I know, things that happen in the book sometimes will be kind of riffs off something that's happened in my life.
Erica, I haven't read your other books yet, and I plan to, but is this a continuation of any of the other stories? Do you sort of, because this is said to be a collection of interconnected short stories, is it also connected to other books of yours?
Yeah, so there are four characters in The Lost Art of Mixing out of the total of eight that come forward from my first novel, The School of Essential Ingredients. And, you know, I didn't set out to write a sequel. I actually started out with Al. And then once I knew that Al was going to need a catalyst in his life, the logical person was Chloe, who is the clumsy busser from the School of Essential Ingredients. And once I had her, all of a sudden three of the others kind of slipped in, and it ended up being this wonderful kind of amalgam of new and old and everyone moving forward.
You had several points of view. So we had Chloe and Al and others in the book. And I was wondering, how do you decide once you set upon a multiple point of view structure, who gets their own point of view chapter?
Well, pretty much every character gets their own chapter. What's different with Lost Art of Mixing is that some characters get two chapters. So in the past, the books have they sort of had a center to them. In School of Essential Ingredients, the center was the cooking school, and it had eight students and their teacher. And each student got their own chapter, and the teacher got her own chapter. And there was a prologue and an epilogue that kind of pulled it all together. And this idea of the school that kind of formed the crux of the whole book. And then with Joy for Beginners, it was seven women who had originally been part of sort of a chemotherapy support circle and a baby-holding circle. And then they end up each challenging each other to do one thing in the next year that is new or difficult or scary. And so in that book, then the structuring principle was each challenge. So each woman had their own chapter, and each challenge went along with it. With Lost Art of Mixing, it became a little more of a chronological narrative. I'm moving a little more toward traditional books, I guess. But the characters started tipping each other. And the structure for this book really was four pairs of characters who are in conflict. But the thing that tips each one forward is a sort of serendipitous happening. So Al's decision to walk into bookstores and start signing other people's books. Or I know you said you wanted me to read, so I don't want to give up. There are a couple of them that are going to actually show up if I read later. They all tend to be very serendipitous happenings that propels the book forward. And so it just seemed logical that some of the stories pick up again later.
You know, this would be a great time to hear you read, Erica, so we can give our listeners a taste of what's going on. Would you please?
Okay. Well, since we've been talking about Al, why don't I start with Al?
Okay.
He's not actually the beginning of the book, but we're going to pretend for a little bit here. A time came, a Monday morning in March. Al was 51, which perhaps played a role in his increased contemplation of his life and that of others. He sat at his desk surrounded by towering stacks of papers, personal lives waiting to be formulated into tax returns. Perusing his clients' financial information was like reading a book in a language few people knew. People gave him numbers, black marks on white paper, without ever realizing the secrets they were revealing. Al knew without looking what his own numbers would say. One spouse, no dependents. No hidden mysteries, no clues to unravel. The simple form, if ever there was one. "I need you to pick up a book for me," Al's wife Louise told him the following Saturday, leaning across the kitchen table to hand him a piece of paper. "I called ahead. They'll have it at the front desk for you." Al looked down at the note in his hand, the title of the book written in his wife's clear, emphatic handwriting, along with directions to the big bookstore where he had, a few months earlier, bought her Christmas present. "Park on the east side of the lot," she had written at the end of the instructions, "in the shade under the trees." As if rereading the note herself, Al's wife nodded suddenly and then reached behind her for the paper towels and pulled several off the roll. "Sometimes there's birds in the trees," she said, handing the towels to him. "Once it dries on the car, it's hard to get off. Make sure you wipe before you drive." Al stood, pushed the wad of paper towels into his jacket pocket, then got his keys from the hook labeled Al by the door and went to his car. He had inherited it when his grandfather died, an old 1958 steel blue Cadillac with fins that seemed to float up into the air. Driving it, he wondered sometimes if it might lift off the ground as he crossed a particularly high bridge. It would take a while before it hit the water below. Perhaps it would be streamlined enough to level out, coast on the currents of air, settle into the water, and simply continue on. The paper towels would likely get wet, though, he thought as he turned on the ignition.
Thank you.
The parking lot... Oops, sorry.
No, go ahead. Sorry, I thought you were...
The parking lot was remarkably busy, even for a Saturday. But the weather was sunny, unusual for March, and Al didn't mind when the only spot he could find was on the unshaded side of the lot. He walked across the black pavement, feeling the first intimations of heat rise up toward him as he watched a young couple, their hands flying in conversation as if waiting for permission to land on the sweet glide slope of the other's body. The book was not at the front desk after all. As Al stood at the service counter waiting for a young woman to track it down, a portly man with curling white hair and a black fedora walked up and introduced himself to the clerk behind the counter. The bookstore was bustling about them, and Al didn't catch the name. The clerk checked the computer screen in front of him and nodded. "Sure," he said to the man. "We have three in stock. I'll go get them." And while Al stood waiting for his wife's copy of Quick Knits for Saturday Night to appear, the clerk sped off and returned with a small stack of books. "Can I get you a pen?" he asked as he set them down in front of the man next to Al. The man shook his head. He pulled a shiny black pen from his jacket pocket, then took the top book from the stack and opened its cover. uncapped the pen, and signed a name in a long, lazy scrawl across the title page. He paused a moment, allowing the ink to dry, then closed the cover and placed the book carefully to one side before repeating the process two more times. It was like watching a priest bless the head of a small child, Al thought, although the author standing next to him was perhaps more pompous than ministerial. Still, there was a reverential quality to the gesture, as if the book somehow changed its chemical composition through the process, becoming heavier with its newly granted importance. It wasn't until he was back in the car that Al realized the clerk had never asked the author for any identification. The author could have been anyone, really. Huh, Al said to himself as he started the car, and then he drove home, thinking.
Thank you so much. That was Erica Bauermeister reading from The Lost Art of Mixing. And you are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm here with Nicole Nelson. You know, as you were reading, and actually earlier, I was thinking about your books and foodie novels, and what someone said to me once who worked at Dutton's Bookstore in Los Angeles, the old Dutton's Bookstore that we miss in Los Angeles. And she said that that foodie novels or words with kitchen or titles with kitchen in them or anything related to food sells really well. And how did you come about doing foodie novels?
Well, you know, it wasn't on purpose. I didn't set out to write anything marketable. I really didn't. We actually got a chance to live in Italy for 2 years back in the late 1990s. And before that point, I really wasn't a very good food person. I'd grown up in a very recipe-based household. Recipes didn't make any sense to me. They were so lockstep. And when we moved to Italy and I was around people who, you know, they treated ingredients like personalities in a conversation, you know, and the whole idea was to put together things that would work well. And I loved that. That was a language I understood. And I think cooking that way affected me both as a human being and a cook, but also as a writer. Because before that point, I'd always wanted to write fiction, but I'd never written fiction. And we returned to the United States, and I took a cooking class. And the first night, we killed crabs with our bare hands, which is what happens when you take a cooking class in the Pacific Northwest as opposed to Italy. But it was this visceral, intimate, shocking activity that I was doing with a group of strangers. And I swear, it wouldn't have been weirder if the teacher had said, okay, now everybody take off your clothes. I mean, it was that strange. And I like to say it shocked me into fiction, because I looked around me and, you know, we're all strangers in this class. Cooking classes tend to be really expensive. You know, usually you go by yourself. And I didn't know any of these people. They didn't know anybody else. And I thought, now, isn't this interesting? I mean, what would happen if you kept, say, 8 people together for the course of a year, and what relationships would form between them, and what would be the food that would be connected to each person that would take them to the next place in their life that would affect them with the same intensity that killing these crabs did for me. And all of a sudden, this framework for a book just fell into my head. And even though I had never created a fictional character, there wasn't some very thinly slightly negative portrayal of one of my sisters, you know, I believed that that the characters would show up. It was like building a house and knowing people would move in. And they did. I mean, it took 6 years, but they did. And I was just lucky that it took 6 years, because during that time, food became a really big deal. And so it got published just right at the right time. But honestly, it was all very serendipitous.
Because it does seem to me that The books that have the best chance of getting published are the books that come out of, I don't know, the writer's passion or telling the story that only they can tell.
Yes, I agree. You know, and I, one of the things that I care about deeply and that shows up in all my books is I love paying attention to those subliminal things in our lives that we don't normally pay attention to. And so, I could have written about perfume, I could have written about music, right now I'm writing about architecture. You know, any of these things that are constantly shaping who we are without our ever knowing it. You know, I could have chosen any of them, I just happen to love food, and that was such a fun one to start with.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned when talking about cooking that you trusted that the characters would come to you, and I've heard you talk a little bit in the past about characters speaking to you. I was wondering if you could tell us about that and what encourages the characters to speak to you?
You know, I have no idea what encourages. You know, I waited till I was 43 and I never heard of one. And I actually, when I was much younger, I went to a reading and I heard this author talking about how the characters talk to her and they hijack the endings of the books, and I thought she was just full of it, you know. And I actually went up to her afterwards, and yeah, I was 22, right, so you say stupid things. And she's signing my book, and I said, you know, I'm a writer, and no characters have ever talked to me. And she just looked at me with the kindest smile and said, well, maybe you're not listening. You know, and it was utterly true. You know, I think, I don't know what happened when I was 43. You know, my children were getting older. I had a little space in my head. I'd spent 2 years in another country trying really, really hard to see the way other people thought. You know, when we lived in Italy, I didn't want to just be a tourist. I wanted to actually understand what it meant to be Italian. And I spent a lot of mental effort doing that. And I think when I came back to the United States, my brain didn't have that fun mental exercise anymore. And so I think a lot of factors came together. But maybe I just started listening. And they did. They showed up one by one. They all showed up.
And I think I read somewhere that repetitive actions for you also tend to be something that helps the characters' voices come more easily, like walking.
Yes, yes. And so, you know, a lot of my books are written underwater, I like to say, you know, when I'm swimming laps. And some of my best inspirations come then. And actually, when I'm cooking, if I ever get stuck on a story and there's food involved, I go and cook the dish that is involved in that chapter. Mm. And that tends to loosen things up. I think any time we can start using our senses as well as our brains, it's really very helpful. And there are plenty of studies that show that repetitive physical activity takes care of a part of your brain that would normally be editing or shutting you down, and it allows the creative process a little better flow in your brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You didn't include recipes in this book, but was that ever a discussion between you and your editor? The possibility?
For the first book, it was. And part of the reason why I didn't do it is that Lillian, the chef, doesn't use recipes. That's one of her big things, is she wants her character, her students, to understand through the process of trusting themselves. And so, but what happened was after the School of Essential Ingredients came out, people started writing me and saying, hey, no fair, you have got to give us some recipes. So they actually are on my website, and my publisher is going to be producing a sort of an expanded ebook close around October, November, that's going to have the recipes at the back of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that.
But with the warning that I am not a cookbook writer, I'm a fiction writer, you know. So, you know, they are as literary as they are instructional, I guess would be the way to put it.
You know, earlier, Erica, you said something about when we were talking about this book being interconnected short stories, or that has tended to be your process, that you were getting into a more traditional structure.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm more like a novel and having a beginning, a middle, and end, and sort of a narrative arc that pulls you through. I mean, all three of my books have that, but this one, Lost Art of Mixing, has just a bit more of one event leads to another event leads to another event with a slightly closer connection. So it feels like I'm tiptoeing toward a novel, which actually is interesting because my next book is a memoir, and it has to have chronological structure, so I guess I'm putting on my training wheels and going.
I also heard that you have written several unpublished memoirs.
Yes, I did. That was, I think, those are what I would call my training books, or what we always call the desk drawer books. So back when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write, I was writing memoirs as things were happening. So I wrote a memoir about being a young mother. I wrote a memoir about renovating a house. But I was writing them as it was occurring. And I learned two things. One is that everything you write has a purpose. So even though those weren't published, that memoir about being a young mother, all of the thought that went into that ended up kind of being crystallized and taken to a different level, and it's two pages of Claire's story in the School of Essential Ingredients. I think the most important part of that memoir. Mm-hmm. And I get more letters about those two pages than anything I've ever written. And so to me, writing that 120-page book before, in order to get two great pages 10 years later, I have no problem with that.
Right.
And the other thing that I learned is when you're writing a memoir, and this seems like a very basic thing, but I think a lot of us miss it, which is that unless you're Bill Clinton or, you know, Brad Pitt, nobody cares about what happened in your life as much as they care about what you learned from what happened. And you don't always know what you've learned at the time. Mm-hmm. So the memoir I'm writing now is about renovating a house that we did 10 years ago. And now I can look back, and I know what I'm talking about. And it's a completely different experience. So I'm really, really glad they weren't published, and I'm really glad I waited.
That's difficult, though, isn't it? I mean, as a new writer and even as a published writer who turns something in and your editor says, no, this isn't going to go, I mean, what do you do with that frustration? And at the time when that happens, you don't necessarily feel like this is a good thing. You feel like, I want to die. I don't like this. This is not good. I'm not a writer. I'm not meant to write. I mean, you know, how do you kind of deal with that frustration?
You know, and that's true. And I kept all the rejections because I had a feeling, and this I think comes from having been a teacher for a lot of years and knowing that even when you can't hear constructive criticism, it's often there. You know, while you're still going, ouch, that hurt. If you wait and you look back, people are saying things that are helpful. You know, now some rejection letters are simply form letters. They should probably just be burned in your fireplace. But every once in a while, someone does take the time to give you an insight that you can use that's helpful. So I tried to kind of put on my teacher cap and save the letters and look back. And there were some that were very helpful later on. At the time, yeah, it hurt like hell. You know, it can take 6 months of rejections before you know that you're done and it's not going to go anywhere.
Mm.
And I think the only thing that made a difference is I'm going to write whether people read it or not.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
It's who I am. It's what I do. And to have it be published, to have it be successful, that's gravy. But it's not who I am.
Mm. That's a great point. And on that, we're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more Erica Bauermeister and the Lost Art of Mixing.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. And we have been here, Nicole and I, with Erica Bauermeister, author of The Lost Art of Mixing, and we're going to bring her back on in a second. But if you want to know anything more about the show, visit penonfire.com. If there are guests you'd like to see on the show or hear on the show, let us know. And if you're in the Orange County area in July, I think it's July 18th, we're having Chris Bojalian down here with his new book, and there's info on that on the website. So let's bring Erica back on. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Erica. Before, we were talking about the many forms you've worked in, you know, novels and memoir, and we didn't even mention the academic writing you've done, but I was wondering if you've also written freestanding short stories?
You know, not as many. I'm working on one right now for a fundraiser up here in Seattle called, it's called Bedtime Stories, and the topic is Pillow Talk, mm-hmm. and I'm having a great deal of fun with that. But, you know, I didn't go the route of sending them out, you know, to the literary magazines, and I guess I'm not as good with rejection as perhaps I was sounding before, because the prospect of sending them out, I heard Willie Vlauten talk one time, and he talked about not wanting to send out his book even to friends to read before, you know, it went anywhere, when he was first writing, because he said it was something he loved doing so much that then if he found out that he wasn't any good, then it would destroy this beautiful thing he had in his life. And I think that's how I felt with the short stories. I was willing to stick with a longer piece just to be able to be with it longer, and then if it got rejected, well, at least I had that time with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it comes down to. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Your work generally is considered women's fiction. How do you feel about that label?
Goodness, I hate that label. You know, I really do. I'm not even sure what it means. I mean, does that mean a woman wrote it? Does it mean a woman reads it? Does it mean there happens to be a woman character in it? Right. You know, there's no equivalent. What do you want, dude fiction, sedlit? I don't know. Actually, Nancy Pearl, who's a really great book reviewer, who wrote Book Lust and other books, she and I have been talking about coming up with an alternate classification system for literature, which would actually break literature down into its component parts, as opposed to its genre or its gender. And so what you would do is you would look at books and you would say, okay, I like, what kind of style do I like? Do I like a lush style? Do I like a lyrical style? Do I want a straightforward Hemingway-esque kind of Cormac McCarthy, you know, short declarative sentence style? Do I like multiple points of view? Do I like unreliable narrators? Do I like a chronological narrative, you know, action-based, character-based? Break it down into all those parts, because when you do that, not only are you pushed beyond stereotypes, but you're also pushed into genres you might not ordinarily read. So I tried that at a bookstore. I said, okay, I like, you know, a good stylist who can write long, complicated sentences. I love unreliable narrators. I love, you know, multiple points of view. And the bookstore owner handed me Gone Girl. And I thought, well, I don't read thrillers. I don't read mysteries that much, you know. I loved that book. So I think if we start thinking of literature in that way, then I think we'll all be better off. Let's just put it that way.
What do you do with revision in terms of, do you have a certain way you go about it, or do you let it sit, your work sit for a really long time before you take it out again, or do you just jump right in after you finish a draft and barrel through?
I do all of those. I mean, I know that sounds weird, but I revise as I go along. I can spend an hour and a half on a paragraph as I'm writing it for the first time. Sometimes I'll write 5-10 pages without stopping. I think this also is because I was a teacher, and when I was in graduate school, we were just, that whole writing group thing, I know this dates me, but the writing group thing was really starting to take hold. And so I really, as a writer, grew up with writing groups, teaching them, being in them. And so I see feedback as helpful and constructive. And so I'm in a writing group. I have 4 or 5 readers outside of my writing group that I rely on heavily. All of those are before anything I write goes to my agent, who has her own editor, which is before it goes to any publisher, who would then have their own editor as well. So I would say any chapter I write probably gets revised at least 12 times, if not many more. And I love it. That's one of my favorite parts of the process, honestly.
That's in terms of your evolution as a writer. I'm going to briefly paraphrase something I heard you say in three stages. You said first it was, ooh, look at me, and then it was, ooh, let me entertain you, and then I care about these characters. I want to do the best I can by them. Is that basically right?
Well, and I think that was part of a talk I gave about the sort of the evolution of a writer, and I do think that there is an evolution for writers that mirrors that of children. So in the beginning, we don't have any way to distinguish ourselves from our surroundings or our parents or anything else, and the whole world is us, and it's very ego-driven. And I think as writers, we have to get beyond that. We have to have it be about the work. And that's partly so that we can take that constructive criticism and we can get better and we can edit. And we can learn to see our work with what I call cold eyes. And sometimes that takes you a long time. You have to put the thing in the desk drawer for 10 years. The more you write, I think, and the more you deal with criticism, the faster it can be. So I can get cold eyes in about a week if I have to on a piece of something I've written. But for me, the biggest step was to get past that, ooh, how fun it was to play with that sentence. Doesn't that sound cool? That kind of teenage version to the grown-up version where I do care about my characters far more than I care about myself. And what I care about is getting them out in the world the way they're supposed to be. And so for me, there's nothing I love more than getting letters from readers where they say, oh, I really took that character into my heart, you know. And I waited with School of Essential Ingredients. It was kind of funny. I actually had this mental checklist, and I wanted to make sure that every single character had been loved deeply by a reader. And when I got to the last one, it was like, yes, okay, they're all safe. They've all got a home somewhere, you know. But that's how I feel about them.
How about, have you ever, and this probably applies more to the early days of writing and probably with your first book or maybe your practice books, I don't know, but I think a lot these days about how we get in our own way with our work and how we get out of the way.
Yeah.
Can you say anything about that? Have you ever had that, you know, feeling that you just have to sort of get out of the way and let it be what it is?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that was part of the problem when I was writing the memoirs initially was it was still too much about me. And I wasn't focusing on my readers. And because, again, what's important is what they learn, not how I sound or, you know, all the bells and whistles I can put into a book. And I think when you want to communicate that, that is a huge difference.
Is it a fine line, though, between, like, writing for your readers and not paying attention to your own, you know, your own heart?
Well, there's a difference between writing what you think will sell and writing for your readers. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the difference between writing to sell and writing to communicate. When you have something that you want to say that you believe someone else might need to hear, that's very different. But honestly, when I'm with the characters, I'm playing with the characters. You know, I am. My husband has this joke where there's a T-shirt you can buy up here that says "All my best friends are fictional," and he says that's my T-shirt because once these people started showing up in my life, and you know, I was 43, my children were early teenagers, and I had never been this way before, but I loved spending time with these people. And I write out loud, and so it really does sound like I'm spending time with them if you're in another part of the house. So they all had to get used to that, and I have to admit they've done it remarkably well.
What do you mean by that, you write out loud?
I say the words as I'm typing them.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, a lot of a book is the musicality of the language. It's odd, but I'm tone deaf, or pretty much so. And the music that I hear is the rhythm of words and sentences. And so I think what happened for me, which I think often happens when you have some kind of, I wouldn't call it a disability, but a disadvantage, is that you then use other skills more strongly. And so for me, because I couldn't hear notes, I heard rhythms. And I can hear the note of a word, the way it shifts within, you know, within the letters of a word or within the words of a sentence. And I pay very close attention to that. And so so I need to hear it aloud.
Hmm. That's interesting. I picked up a John Gardner book. I think it's The Art of Fiction. And I remember from years ago reading this book, and the effect it had on my writing, because he has a chapter or at least a few pages dedicated to the musicality of your sentences, and he graphs it out, where the emphasis falls. And I found that so interesting to think about sentences and words as you would music.
Yeah. Well, in the writing group that I'm in, writing groups have different structures. And a lot of times what people do is they just give each other pages ahead of time, edit them, come together and talk about it. And that's never worked for me. The group I'm in, what we do is we bring the work to the writing group, and then we read it aloud. And there's something that happens when I read my work aloud to myself, but there's something that happens when I read it aloud to an audience, that I can hear things differently. And I think that level of attention is important as well.
Mm-hmm.
Are there authors you can share with us who you admire in particular for their rhythm?
Diane Ackerman, who's a science writer who's also a poet, and I think what an astonishing combination. I read her Natural History of the Senses, I don't know how many times when I was writing School of Essential Ingredients. If you want to be a writer who uses their senses in their writing, Natural History of the Senses is a perfect way to kind of prime the pump. But I also love, Joanne Harris is a beautiful, beautiful writer. And, I just read The Snow Child, which I thought was lovely. An odd one, because it's a translation that I read last year, was The Art of Hearing Heartbeats. It was originally written in Dutch. But the English translation is so beautiful that you just want to swim in the sentences.
Back to The Lost Art of Mixing. Each character, and again, you have, what, 7 point of view characters?
8.
Eight, okay. So, well, a couple of things. One is that I found the way you shifted from one to another was pretty much seamless. I mean, you just kind of melded from, one to the other. And as well, each one seemed to have a purpose. And we hear this all the time. Your characters need to have a purpose. What do your characters want? What's at stake? Is this a conscious choice on your part, or is it just the way your mind works and, a character comes out and they need something?
I think it is more the latter, and then the trick is pulling all of those together. So, it's a very interesting combination when I write these interconnected short stories of an absolute lack of control when I'm working with the characters, because if I let them go where they want to go, the story will always be more interesting. If I force them to do something, it generally doesn't work. And so I have to see where they want to go, and then I have to trust that all those pieces will come together, that there's a part of my brain, a very unconscious part of my brain, that knows how this is all going to fit. And then there is this very organized, very highly structured act of putting the pieces together and figuring out what order they go in and what the connections are, and then kind of going back and reweaving things so that it all fit together. But I have these huge charts, that are chronological charts, that are character charts, that are arrows all over the place. It's kind of scary looking, actually, when you get to see it. But in the end, hopefully, it does make it feel exactly that, seamless.
So, in terms of your charts, this is interesting. Talk a little more about this. I mean, is this something you start from the beginning as you start writing a draft, or is this something that happens after you have a draft down and now you're charting out what's happening and who's there?
Well, I use a technique that, again, I learned in graduate school, so, I always kind of laugh at my degree sometimes. I learned such pivotal things there, and one of them was mind mapping. So I cannot outline a book in a linear form. It doesn't work for me. It's kind of like using recipes. There's all of a sudden this layer of plastic between me and the thing that I want to be working with. So for me, what I do is I have a giant sketchbook, and every character, their name goes in the center of a double spread of a page. And then I just start, as ideas come, I just sort of connect them out. So it starts looking, I don't know. You know what those mind maps look
mm-hmm,
like.
Mm-hmm,
all those little
sure.
bubble map things.
Mm-hmm.
So I just create bubble maps, and then I'll create one for the entire book, and I will start drawing the connections between the characters. And when I look at it that way, I can start to say, okay, I see who starts. I see who goes next. I see who tips to the next person. That was a little trickier with the first two books because the order wasn't as natural as it is in Lost Art of Mixing, because Lost Art of Mixing is fairly chronological. But even with Lost Art of Mixing, I did move one of the stories much later to the end of the book that was originally toward the front in order to kind of pull the narrative tension through.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine, and we are with Erica Bauermeister. Her book is The Lost Art of Mixing, and I should say that it's published by Putnam. Okay.
And I was taking notes during our discussion about charts. That sounds like something worth trying. But in the section you read earlier from your book, that when I read that, I didn't like Louise. And so I was delighted when I was dropped into Louise's head to get to know her better and gain sympathy for her. And I was wondering if you would read some more from your book.
Sure. Well, one offside about Louise is that I didn't expect her to be in the book. This is part of the serendipity of all of us. And I was at this cabin, lovely, peaceful cabin, woke up one morning and there's Louise in my head, and I thought, I do not want you in my head because I like Al and I like not liking you. The world is simpler when I don't like you, when you're just the wife. And but the more Louise talked, the more I liked her, and the more I felt as if, okay, maybe I am a little bit of Louise. Maybe we're all a little bit of Louise. Maybe we all wish that people would pay attention to all the things we're doing for them during the day and maybe help out a little more. And it was when she came into the book and I wrote her story and I had Al's story and Louise's story, and I realized that they were diametrically opposed to each other, and I realized that that was going to be the structure of the book because I was holding two different opinions in my head at the same time, and I was able to do that. And I realized that that was a really good thing to be able to do, and that that was going to be the structure of the book. I was going to have four opposing viewpoints, or really eight, four pairs of opposing viewpoints, and that that was going to be the point of the book. It starts with a quote from Aesop, "Every truth has two sides." And I think by the time you're done, hopefully, as readers, we have the compassion to hold all of them in our heads. So you could choose. I was going to read from Lillian, but I can read from Louise if you'd rather. Which do you want?
Louise is great.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to have to find Louise. Give me a second.
And if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late, but we have been with Erica Bauermeister, The Lost Art of Mixing. And if you have just tuned in, this show, along with the others, will be podcast. The archive is at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And when a new podcast goes up, it goes up on the website, penonfire.com. So you can use either one to find a show. Anyway.
Okay. So this is the first time I've ever read Louise out loud in public, so this is going to be fun. Louise had been an only child, reluctant to arrive, yanked from her mother's body, leaving behind a footpath of wreckage. Her parents had viewed their new offspring warily. She was an unknown who had entered their lives. They had opened a door expecting a guest and encountered a robber. Even as a baby, Louise could sense the way their eyes skittered off her face. Their smell would grow sharp at the edges as they came near her. As she got older, her parents became more adept at covering their feelings, cheering her heartily during kindergarten theatrical performances, posting her report cards riddled with A's on the refrigerator. But Louise knew better. Even in kindergarten, she could act better than that. As an adolescent, she discovered a deep reservoir of resentment that the blame had been laid so unreflectively upon her own infant head. She had not, after all, made herself. It was not her fault that her father had lost his sexual playground and would look elsewhere. Not her fault that her mother felt compelled to fill her life with anything that didn't have to do with child rearing, running off in her nylon stockings and Jackie Kennedy hat to one committee or another. It was perhaps more a sign of the disunion of her parents' marriage, that the combination of the two of them would create something that would get stuck, she thought, as she lay on her bed, planning how to make her entry into the world of grown-ups something graceful and effortless. And so she studied those about her, both her peers and those older than she, the ones who already had attained the goal of self-sufficiency and social acceptance. She slept with her hair tightly wound around coffee cans to straighten the waves that got in one's way in high school hallways. She learned the tilted head cock of a listener, the silent nodding encouragement that warmed people into volubility and left them with the impression that she was the most interesting person in the room. She learned not to love silence, and she kept herself slim, shiny, no hard angles that would catch and stall her delivery into the realm of boyfriends, all the while reciting the lines that were like passwords in the secret club of girls. I'm so fat. My parents are driving me crazy. I can't wait to get out of here. It had been a relief to meet Al in some ways. That day in the college cafeteria, he had been like a child holding out a broken bowl and asking her to fix it, his eyes so earnest as he explained to her about his fascination with numbers, when in fact their conversation had had nothing to do with numbers at all. She understood better than he what he was looking for, a place to stand still. She could do that. She had been born doing that.
Thank you so much. That was Erica Bauermeister reading from The Lost Art of Mixing. And I'm thinking of something you said earlier, which is that you read your writing aloud as you're writing. And your dialogue is wonderful. It's very sparse and good. And I was thinking that it was just enough. And I wonder if part of that is your technique of reading aloud as you type.
It might be. You know, I actually had to work really hard on dialogue when I started back, I don't know, what is this, 15 years ago now. And I really had to learn to listen very carefully to what people were saying, even sitting in coffee shops and just writing down verbatim what people said, just to kind of learn the rhythms of dialogue, because I was so used to playing with more elaborate sentences in my head. So thank you. It's something I've worked at very hard.
One of your characters is a woman with Alzheimer's, and I was intrigued by her. What were there any challenges to writing that character?
Yes. Actually, Isabel is a character that comes forward from the School of Essential Ingredients, and she is one of my favorite characters I've ever written. I love her probably more than any of them. And she came out of a desire to understand that kind of degradation of memory and brain. My father had frontal lobe dementia, was part of the disease he died of, and I wanted to understand what that felt like, and for me the best way is through fiction. And so while Isabel is nothing like my father, in many ways she was created because of him. And then I had to, because I didn't want to use what he had, I wanted to use Alzheimer's, which I think in many ways is more prevalent in our culture. I did a lot of research into Alzheimer's and read some truly heartbreaking first-person memoirs, essays written as the person went into Alzheimer's, as well as a lot of technical books, just to make sure it's too important a thing to get wrong.
Mm-hmm. Erica, we're just about at the end of our time, but I wondered if you had any advice that you've received along the way that stuck with you and has helped you even now after a few books.
You know, I think the thing that that I've realized, and that I was told early on but I didn't really realize it until later, is that a writer is who you are, just like a mother is who I am. And the fact that no one has ever paid me for being a mother does not diminish the fact that I am one. And so, you know, when you're not published, that doesn't mean you're not a writer. I have so many people come up to me and say, I write, but I'm not a writer because I'm not published. And, I mean, what does that mean? You know, what is it about our society that makes people feel that way? You know, if you're a writer, it's how you see the world. It's how you pay attention to, you know, that couple you don't know across a coffee shop, or the people in an airport, or, you know, the line of a building, or the green of a tree. It's with the way you process information, and that's the most important thing about it, and everything else is, you know, whether you're published, whether you're paid, that's gravy.
Yeah, that's a hard one, because I'm thinking of a friend I have that she had quite a few novels out at the time, and her ex-husband, now ex-husband, who worked in, you know, I don't know, nuclear science or something, he said, I'll take you seriously when you make as much money as I do.
I hate that. It's not true, and it's not fair.
Yeah. I mean, and she was published, you know, and she's like, whoa, they're not together anymore. So,
well, no, there may be a reason for that.
There may be a reason. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I really like this book, and I like that, you know, there's so much suspense within it that it's not a suspense novel. And there, yet you've written suspense throughout the book, and I think that's that there's an art to that, and we can all learn from that. So thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks, Erica.
That was Erica Baumeister. Her book is The Lost Art of Mixing, published by Putnam. And we get a lot of food novels along the way, I think. And I don't know, I like foodie novels, but I put a lot in the discard pile. I don't know about you, Nicole, but I love this one. It was very enjoyable, and I was up actually at 3 a.m. reading it, finishing it last night, or tonight, this morning, whenever that was.
And for me, it was the interaction of the characters and the subtleties that drew me in.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, she goes way deep into, you know, these characters, and it's like, oh, okay, it's something I can learn from, which is always a wonderful thing when you're a writer reading. Anyway, we're at the end of our time. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. And if you'd like to know more about the show, past shows, the salons coming up, go to penonfire.com. Next week, Marie Stone will be here with Joan Silber and Colin McCann. He's back. He wrote The Great World. What was it called? It was like a National Book Award winner. Why am I not thinking of this book? The Great World Spins?
Oh, Let the Great World Spin?
Yeah. Okay. This is his next novel, and it should be a good one. So thank you so much for listening, and great to be here with you, Nicole.
Oh, always a pleasure, Barbara.
See you next time.